Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, July 21, 2014, during a live courthouse steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call. Today, our teleforum will review the criminal law and procedure cases of the just-concluded U.S. Supreme Court term. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to today's call two experts. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of about 10 minutes, and then maybe some discussion between the two of them. But as always, we'll be looking to you for your questions, so please do be ready with the audience questions. We're going to hear first from Dean Mazzoni. He is the Chief of the Enterprise and Major Crimes Division at the Massachusetts Attorney General's Office. And then we'll hear from Kent S. Scheidegger. He is the Legal Director and General Counsel of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. And then ultimately to your questions. So with that, Dean Mazzoni, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. As the other dean said, my name is Dean Mazzoni. I'm an assistant attorney general in the Criminal Bureau in the Massachusetts Attorney General's Office. And as Dean also said, anything I say now is my personal opinion, not an official opinion of the Massachusetts Attorney General. Fourth Amendment cases in the United States Supreme Court in this past term. We had some blockbusters, which I'm sure, well, maybe really one real blockbuster that I'm sure most people listening to this podcast are aware of. And I'm talking about what's become known as the cell phone cases. That is Riley v. California and United States v. Worry, its companion case. And as the cases themselves say, they raise a common question, whether the police may, without a warrant, search digital information on a cell phone seized from an individual who has been arrested. And this case got a lot of attention when it was decided back on June 25th of 2014. And it was important mainly because it saw a very standard legal criminal doctrine collide with improving technology, of which everybody is aware. That is, it's always been the case, or has traditionally been the case, that one of the exceptions to the warrant requirement for a search has always been a search incident to arrest. That is, if someone is lawfully arrested, their effects, that is, what's in their pockets and their hands, can be searched. Primarily for two reasons, for officer safety and for search of evidence of criminal evidence of criminal wrongdoing. But as we all know, people now have what Judge Roberts said, an alien from another planet would think is another appendage on our persons, which is our cell phones, which, as again we all know, carry a huge volume of personal information, location information, photographs, videos. The mind boggles as to what the typical smartphone can carry. So the idea that you can analogize it to, say, a wallet or a physical notebook in terms of what someone can look at is just, you know, doesn't work, the Supreme Court said. That is, it's not just the difference of degree, it's a difference in kind. To call a modern-day smartphone just a container which can be looked through, with the only justification being that the person on whose person that container is has been lawfully arrested, just does not comport with today's standards of privacy. As the court noticed, a smartphone of the sort taken from Riley was unheard of even 10 years ago. That is, that the technology has evolved such that the standard doctrine for searches incident to arrest just don't hold. And I'll point to some particularly colorful language that Judge Roberts noted, was that where the United States asserted in that case that a search of all data stored on a cell phone is materially indistinguishable from searches of these sorts of physical items, that is, a wallet, an address book, is like saying a ride on a horseback is materially indistinguishable from a flight to the moon. Both are ways of getting from point A to point B, but little else justifies lumping them together. So this is a case that was closely watched by all members of the criminal practice community, defense attorneys, judges, prosecutors. If before the argument, I would have said it was a unanimous opinion. Riley and Worry were unanimous. It seemed like that's where the cases were going. The oral argument was kind of caught me a little bit by surprise because they asked tough questions of the defendants. But in the end, the court came down where it came down and had made a special exception for digital evidence, that is, items on cell phones. The court noted that, you know, the search incident arrest to even though the search incident to arrest exception doesn't apply to cell phones, the other case-specific exceptions may still justify a warrantless search of a particular phone in particular circumstances. That is, and what's known in the criminal law as exigency. If there's some emergency, you know, the idea of, you know, remotely triggering a bomb, of course, these are the hypotheticals that you always get, and the government did give to the court in that case. They said that would be, if there is an exigency, that could be covered if that's the case in any particular case. But as a general matter, cell phones are now an exception to the traditional rule of a search incident to arrest. Again, it was a unanimous opinion. Justice Alito wrote an interesting concurrence where he talked about the idea that, you know, some maybe legislation would help, and that in fact, you know, it is may be something that Congress would want to look at in the future. So that's Riley. It took up a lot of my time, I know, with that case, but it's a pretty important case. It's very easy. I don't know if there are non-lawyers listening, but the layperson can read the opinion. It's pretty straightforward. It's not that complicated. Not a lot of acrimony, so not a lot of fireworks from the court. Again, it was unanimous except for it was a unanimous opinion. Moving on to another case, which is quite an interesting case and has to do with a Fourth Amendment case, which is Fernandez, which is a co-occupant consent to search. So it's another point along the lines of what's private and what isn't, what you need, what courts need a warrant for, what you don't. If the police knock on someone's door, they are always able to ask to search. That is, you can get consent from someone without a warrant, and that's perfectly permissible. If the person is the owner or the tenant, they have an absolute right to tell the police that, you know, feel free to search my home without a warrant. A few years ago, in a case called Randolph, which is the precursor to the Fernandez case. That case involved a narrow exception to the rule that police officers may search jointly occupied premises if one of the occupants consents. That is, husband and wife, one says, you know, sure, you can search, and the search is fine. But in Georgia v. Randolph in 2006, the court held that the consent of one occupant is insufficient when another occupant is present and objects to the search. That is, say, husband and wife or two brothers or two co-tenants who have the same authority over the area of the home. If one says, sure, come in and search, you don't need a warrant, and the other is present and says, no, I'm objecting, then in Randolph, the court said you cannot use the consent of one. That the consent of one of the co-tenants does not override the objection of the other. In Fernandez versus California, post-Randolph, an interesting twist, police get a call of, I believe it's a domestic violence call. They go to the scene, and they knock on the door of the apartment. They hear screams inside. The woman opens the door. She's holding a baby. She appears to be crying. Her face is red. She had a bump in her nose, blood in her shirt and hands that appeared to be fresh. Officers ask if anyone else is in the home, and the woman says, yeah, her four-year-old son was the only other person present apart from the defendant. They ask the woman to step out so they can perform a protective sweep, but the defendant appears and says, you don't have any right to come in here. I know my rights. Suspecting that the defendant had actually assaulted the woman, the officers removed them from the apartment, placed them under arrest, and an hour later, it went back to the apartment where the woman was, told her that the defendant was arrested, and asked if they could search the premises. She said, yes, you could. And at that time, they found evidence of criminal activity, including a hidden sawed-off shotgun, which the defendant had no right to be in possession of. So at that point, the rule of Randolph comes into play. The person wasn't physically there to object, but he did object. Was taken out of the house by police that is lawfully arrested. And whether the rule of Randolph is so strict, that is that the person who objects has to be there to object at the time of the search. And there was a lot of conflicting authority from different federal courts of appeals on that point. And the Supreme Court affirmed that, yes, the rule of Randolph is very strict, and that in Fernandez, the fact that the defendant was not present to object at the time of the search takes it out of the ambit of Randolph. And there was a dissent. I believe the case was 5-4. There was a pretty good contentious dissent, fun to read, where, you know, the idea is that, look, you took the guy who objected out of the house, and now you feel like you can just get consent. And the court said yes. You can read the opinion for the rationale, but basically any other rule, as strict as it may sound, as formalistic as it may sound, any other rule is unworkable. I've been eating up my time. I see that. Sorry, Kent. I'll just mention one other case, which is Navarette, which is another interesting Fourth Amendment case, Navarette v. California, that says that an anonymous tip to a 911 call, where the anonymous tipster says a car just drove me off the road and it's driving on the highway south, whatever the highway was, police identify the car on the highway, driving, follow it for 5 minutes, don't see any, at that time, any evidence of driving to endanger or operating erratically or anything like that. Nevertheless, they pull them over just based on the stop, the fact that they got a tipster saying that the car was driving dangerously, ran me off the road, and that case was 5-4, has a fiery dissent by Judge Scalia, joined by several other justices, and that basically is it reasonable to stop a car in those circumstances solely based on what is, in effect, an anonymous tip? The case is very interesting to read as a practical matter, certainly is for law enforcement, and the Scalia dissent is worth reading. Sorry, I ate up a lot of my time. Sorry, Kent.
No problem.
That's it for me. Thanks.
Go right ahead, Kent Scheidegger.
Okay, this is Kent Scheidegger. One group of cases that I kind of lump together are capital cases, habeas corpus cases, and ineffective assistance cases. Those are three different categories, but there's lots of overlap, so you usually have to consider them together. By way of disclosure, let me say that I wrote amicus briefs in three of these cases, White v. Woodall, Cheever versus Kansas, and the Hall case. So two out of three is not bad. The one that got the most publicity was the Hall case from Florida, which has to do with defining intellectual disability, which is the new term for mental retardation, for the purpose of exemption from capital punishment. The court some years back in the Atkins case had decided that mentally retarded persons would be categorically exempt from capital punishment regardless of the circumstances of the crime. So the question became how to define who actually is intellectually disabled. Florida had a system where they were using IQ tests, and not only using them rigidly, but using them without considering the standard error of measurement of the test, which, to be honest, is scientifically indefensible. But the real question as a constitutional matter is how far the Supreme Court was going to get into the weeds of technical definitions in terms of imposing a constitutional requirement on a technical question. And the court did split narrowly on that, but ruled in favor of Hall, saying that Florida's method of defining intellectual disability was unconstitutional. The narrow holding of the case is that you have to consider the standard error of measurement and that Florida's system would otherwise be okay. That in itself won't affect very many cases, But there are some disturbing implications in the opinion, particularly their heavy reliance on the manual of the American Psychiatric Association, which is not an unbiased source in this area. So we'll have to keep an eye on that case as far as any implications for the future. Another capital case, White versus Woodall, had to do with when a person is entitled to an instruction that the jury is not permitted to make any adverse inference from the fact he did not testify. Supreme Court precedent requires that instruction upon the defendant's request in the guilt phase of a criminal trial. The Sixth Circuit said that this rule extended to the penalty phase of a capital case, and that the state courts were unreasonable in refusing to extend Supreme Court precedent farther than the Supreme Court itself had ever extended it. The Supreme Court corrected them on that notion. The reform passed by Congress in 1996 said that only unreasonable applications of Supreme Court precedent can be grounds to overturn a state court decision. And it's not unreasonable for a state court to say the Supreme Court hasn't gone that far yet and we're not going there. The Cheever case had to do with a compelled mental examination of a defendant making a mental defense. It's a unanimous decision, not very difficult. It's pretty well established under the federal rules of evidence that if the defendant's making a mental defense, then the prosecution is entitled to have its own exam of the defendant, which he must participate in. So that examination and the resulting use of it in evidence is not deemed to violate the privilege against self-incrimination. A couple other cases, there's one on ineffective assistance arising out of Alabama, and an ineffective assistance case arising from federal habeas. And the court went one way on one of those. Burt v. Titlow, the government won. And the Hinton v. Alabama case, the defendant won. There's not too much patterns as far as substance goes. The government wins three of these cases. The defendant wins two. The one pattern that is clear, though, is that the two cases arising out of federal courts on habeas corpus, the government both won. The two cases the court took directly from state courts on state collateral review, the defendant both won. And I think what that means is the Supreme Court is really serious about enforcing Congress's limits on federal habeas corpus, and they understand that that necessarily requires that they be more diligent in correcting clear errors when they arise on state collateral review of criminal convictions. There are several cases on federal criminal statutes, some of them pretty minor. Two cases that make kind of an interesting contrast are the Bond case and the Castleman case. They both have to do with federal criminal statutes, whether to construe them broadly or narrowly, and possible constitutional implications if they are construed broadly. The Bond case involved a chemical weapon terrorism statute that, if construed simply on its face, would pretty much make a federal case out of anybody who uses any chemical to commit any crime. The court decided that it would not construe it that broadly, and instead more narrowly in terms of what you would normally think of as chemical weapons. In contrast to that, we have the Castleman case, where Congress has prohibited gun possession by anybody convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. And the court construed that pretty much on its face, as you would think hurting somebody is a crime of violence, and if that person is your spouse, it's a crime of domestic violence. When they get to the Second Amendment issue, they simply say, well, the defendant didn't raise the Second Amendment issue, the statute is clear, we're not going to worry about that. In contrast to Bond, which had been thought to be a big constitutional question as to how far Congress can go in enforcing treaties, because the chemical weapons ban arises from a treaty, and they ducked the constitutional issue by construing the statute narrowly in the defendant's favor. So that made kind of an interesting contrast in terms of constitutional avoidance. That's about all I have on these cases. If you want to go to the questions now, we can do that, Dean.
All right. Thank you very much. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who rings in, I'll start things off by asking Dean Mazzoni a question. Dean, you heard Kent Scheidegger talk about trends or patterns. I'm wondering if you saw any patterns or trends emerge in this term, or even going back a term or two that continued throughout this term. Let me see. I think we've got Dean Mazzoni's phone on mute. So, go ahead, Dean. We can hear you now.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Thank you, Dean. Along with as I mentioned, Riley and Worry, I do think you are seeing, and with Scalia, especially in the Navarette case, you are seeing a strong Fourth Amendment. I won't say so much pro-defendant as pro-privacy. Strain, and which is not necessarily going to be pro-law enforcement, even among what would be seen as conservative justices. Again, especially Scalia, who's really strict on the Fourth Amendment when it comes to law enforcement. And you know, the Worry case and the Riley case, kind of a no-brainer. I think people would see it. You know, the average layperson on the street. I think it was unanimous. There was a lot of agreement on it. So I would say there's not so much a reflexive pro-law enforcement tone to even the conservative justices, that they'll look closely at these kind of cases. And speaking from a prosecutor's perspective, we don't take anything, not that we ever did, but we don't take anything for granted when it comes to, you know, searches and seizures and all that. And I think that the conservative justices are getting more sensitive to those privacy issues. So there are other cases that will surely come down the line when it comes to computers and digital evidence and digital searches. But I definitely think that the idea that police can just search these things willy-nilly just by, you know, with a simple justification, the person's been arrested or charged or whatever, that's kind of gone by the boards when it comes to the Fourth Amendment. So that's what I see.
Does the analysis get different when there are national security interests at heart, or at least arguably so?
Arguably so. I'm sure that would be the case. I mean, we'll see when it comes to like standing issues, when it comes to the NSA thing. People are looking at that, you know, a year or two down the road, and there will be concerns. But the justices are human, and as we get further and further away from, I think, again, my personal opinion, from, you know, 9/11 and that kind of thing, I think, you know, the idea that, you know, national security, so we can't, you know, there's no standing to question NSA surveillance and all that. I think you'll see that getting chipped away as the years go on. I think I could be wrong. So,
a few terms ago, Justice Scalia became notable, I guess, among other things, for his Confrontation Clause jurisprudence, allowing, I guess, defendants to confront witnesses, including lab technicians and folks like that.
Melendez-Diaz came out of Massachusetts, was the kind of the landmark case along those lines, so yes.
Right, and there was talk when that came out about it being really disruptive to the law enforcement community and to the trial process. Has that come to pass? Has it been as cataclysmic or as disruptive as people predicted, or how is the law enforcement community and the legal
Speaking from Massachusetts only, of course I'm speaking from Massachusetts, right? In my experience here in Massachusetts and in my personal opinion, I think, you know, going forward, the idea of putting on the chemist who actually performed the test, say, or the lab technician is who actually performed the test, which we didn't have to do a few years ago, is something we've accommodated ourselves to. I can personally say that I've done it. It's not, you know, I don't want to say it's not a big deal, but we could accommodate that. We could put the chemist on. We need more resources, of course, like everybody does, to have the chemist who wants you to be able to stay in the lab and just do the tests. Now they come in and testify, but we've been able to handle that. Looking back, for people who've had their convictions overturned, that became an issue in the sense that I don't have the exact figures to hand, but a lot of convictions did get overturned. And, you know, however that results in either new trials or, you know, pleas afterwards, or, you know, time served resolutions, stuff like that. Again, I can personally speak to, I have numerous cases still in the pipeline that have gotten reversed because of those reasons. And that's just more cases that we have. But so again, going forward, it's fine. I think going back to, you know, unsettling prior convictions is an issue we have to deal with. There are no cataclysms. So.
All right, Ken Scheidegger, we've got a couple callers with questions at this point. Did you want to weigh in before we go to the audience?
Just briefly on the Fourth Amendment. I've seen a pattern over the past number of years distinguishing substantive Fourth Amendment cases from cases about the exclusionary remedy, where the focus of the case is the substantive Fourth Amendment, which all three cases this year were. What Dean said is completely correct. You do see some of the so-called conservative justices frequently voting for the defendant. Where the issue is whether and to what extent evidence should be excluded on the grounds of Fourth Amendment, you see more of the traditional conservative liberal lineup, and you see the court more willing to carve out exceptions. They haven't shown an indication of actually overruling Mapp v. Ohio yet, but they seem to be more and more chopping it down to cover basically the bad faith intentional violations.
I agree with that 100%. This is Dean Mazzoni. I agree with Kent's observation.
Let's go to the audience to take a question.
Yeah, hi. This is Bill Otis, and I'm grateful both for Dean Mazzoni and for my friend Ken Scheidegger's participation today, and I always learn a lot from Kent, and I have again today. The question I have, it's actually a couple of related questions, is about this Riley cell phone case, which Dean Mazzoni aptly and correctly referred to as a no-brainer. When I worked in the Department of Justice, I would occasionally draft briefs on the merits in criminal cases, and it was thought that it would be best if the department and the Solicitor General's office, in fact, operated with a brain rather than without one in making assertions in Supreme Court cases. For the department to assert that a cell phone, which, you know, everyone in the modern world understands has a person's entire life on it, is similar to a wallet or a cigarette pack, is in fact a no-brainer, and it's no surprise that the government got not a single vote. But it goes beyond that case. The government's record in this administration of losing all 9 votes is beyond that of prior administrations by a fairly well. I think it lost all 9 a dozen times this term, and over President Obama's entire term has lost unanimously significantly more than any recent previous administration. So I wonder whether our panelists could have any views on what is going on with the Solicitor General's office. When I was there, the rule was that you would make any arguably defensible contention in favor of a statute or your client's interests, but the contention that a cell phone is just like a cigarette pack is not arguably defensible and ought never to have been made. Someone in the department should have said, guys, we can't put this in the brief. And if they had, they would have avoided embarrassment. They still would have lost the case, but they wouldn't have looked bad doing it. By contrast, for example, in their litigation about the Defense of Marriage Act, and I'm not going to take a position, and I'm on whether that's constitutional or not, but it's arguably constitutional, and the department refuses to defend it at all, even though a legitimate, even if not a winning argument, can be made. So my question is, does the Solicitor General's office record over this administration show that the government is making arguments less on the basis of what is defensible and more on the basis of what is suitable to its political constituency groups?
May I respond just very briefly? Dean? May I say something?
Yes, of course. Go right ahead.
I'll just say that you know, the government lost 9-0 and Worry and Riley. If you're implying that the argument that the government made was frivolous, although it lost, I don't agree with that. I don't think it was frivolous. I think it was an application of, as I said, pretty standard search and seizure law. Now, you can argue, and I think it makes sense in hindsight, right, to say that, you know, what someone has in their wallet, you know, how can you compare that to what someone has in a smartphone? You know, several years ago, I made these kinds of arguments and prevailed, you know, in the state courts that, you know, you open up a wallet, you open up an address book, you're seeing things, you're reading things. It's the same in a cell phone. But I think as the years go on, there's so much more that is now on a smartphone that can be on videos that in the end, you know, the standard rule just, you know, wouldn't fit with these cell phones, and that an exception was warranted. But I wouldn't say the argument that the government made was frivolous or in bad faith at all, even though they lost 9-0. That's just my opinion. So,
Kent Scheidegger, do you want to weigh in here on the?
Not really. federal DOJ's win loss record is one aspect of the Supreme Court trends that I haven't tallied, so I am not really able to respond to that.
Okay. We've got two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call. The caller, you might have your telephone muted yourself.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Hi, sorry about that. So my name is Andy Carstein. I'm here in D.C. I actually work for the DEA, but, you know, like you guys, everything I say or imply is my own opinion. I was just wondering the implications on the Riley cell phone cases. Obviously, you know, the writ of cert limited it to searches incident to arrest, but really, do you think that the reasoning and the language in it is really going to end up applying to so many other warrant exceptions? You know, I think off the top of my head, the automobile exception, the inventory exception, things like that, is basically cell phone going to be off limits in all those cases, except maybe exigent circumstances?
This is Dean Mazzoni. I'll just be very quick, so I'll let Kent weigh in, because I think I've been doing a lot of talking. I think the court and the public generally has been pretty good about seeing the cell phone as, you know, sui generis and a unique circumstance. You know, here's this container that can contain, you know, so much stuff and the fit in the palm of people's hands. I don't think the you know, the inventory, cars, I think that's all gonna stay extant, all that. But I do think cell phones are a really special case, and the court was pretty explicit. And I don't see, certainly not the Supreme Court, you know, extending, you know, those kinds of protections to other kind of circumstances. But maybe Kent has some ideas on that.
Oh, yeah, this is Kent. No, basically, I agree with that. I think probably the logic does extend to other warrant exceptions. You know, the smartphone, there are actually two cases. Riley had a smartphone, and Worry had a dumb phone. The smartphone, having all your correspondence on it, I think really struck a chord. I mean, that's one of the things that the original Fourth Amendment was most sensitive about protecting. And I expect that probably all warrant exceptions are out unless there's truly exigent circumstances. Other than that, I think it's a matter of, you know, disable the phone so it can't be wiped and then go get the warrant.
Again, we're speaking with Dean Mazzoni and Kent Scheidegger. We've got two questions pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take yet another call. Again, caller, if you have your telephone muted yourself, you need to come off mute on your end. Okay, let's try another caller. Go ahead, caller, with your question. Is the caller there? We can't hear you. If you're on mute, you need to unmute your own telephone. Maybe we're having some difficulties with our telephone system here, but we have one more question pending, so let's try this next caller and see if we can actually get the caller on the line.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine. Go right ahead, sir.
Mine's Drew Willian with the new lawyer down in Houston, but I was wondering, how do y'all feel the exception is going to apply to non-content-based information from the cell phone, like cell tower, historical cell tower location data?
Well, do you mean what cell towers the cell phone has been in contact with?
Yes.
Yeah, so right now they'll use what cell tower. So when you move across to certain cell towers, they'll use it to show, you know, the person hasn't been in this location or this neighborhood or whatever. And do you think the warrant requirement, because of the language in Worry and Riley, do you think that could extend the warrant requirement to non-content-based information like those records, location-like records?
Well, Kent, this is Dean Mazzoni. I think the court is well aware of cell site location information being able to be, you know, gleaned from inside the cell phone, and they talk a little about it. Cell site location information can also be gotten from the third party, that is the cell phone provider itself. We often do that, usually with a search warrant. Always with a search warrant. The idea of doing it without a warrant, the idea of getting any information at all from the cell phone, that is the physical cell phone, without a warrant, I think that's gone. You're going to need a warrant. You can write for, when we say write for, that's the term we use, it's kind of a term of art. You can write for a phone. You can articulate the reasons to a judge after you disable it, as Kent said, you know, why you think there's going to be evidence of the crime on the phone, and you know, any investigator really would be able to, usually in the circumstances I'm envisioning, articulate a reason why. So again, I think you're gonna, as Kent said, you're gonna need a warrant. If you're gonna get it from that phone, that information from that phone, you're gonna need a warrant, just as you'd need it for a home or whatever, because that's kind of the analogy. So
doesn't the third-party cell phone provider really hold all of that information anyway?
That's correct. That's why I say you can get it exactly. You can get that kind of information from the third party, and that's a hotly contested issue in all jurisdictions, that the third party keeps those records and how you can get them. I said we can get them with a search warrant. You can get them with a subpoena. But you're not going to get them from the phone, you know. But whatever you get from the phone itself, you're going to need a warrant. And maybe I'm not correct. If I'm not, maybe Kent can talk about that.
Yeah, I think the old you see a lot of discussion in old cases about pen registers, which is
right.
Old technology. But the underlying principle of those cases is probably still valid. That whatever you could get from a third party, you can still get from the third party.
How is that valid?
I'm sorry.
How do they rationalize that, or how is that valid to get them with pen registers from third parties?
Because when you...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. This is Dean Mazzoni. Because when you provide, the law is, it may change, that whatever you provide to a third party, you're giving up your privacy interest, and that the fact that the third party can then turn around and give it to a fourth party or a fifth party or a sixth party, you've lost your protection when you do that. That's, again, something that may be revisited. Certainly it's being challenged again, that doctrine, but the third party doctrine, as a federal matter, as a constitutional matter, still stands. So if your records are in the hands of a third party, you lose your privacy interest in it. Is that correct, Kent?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, thank you.
We do have another question pending. If you want to ask a question of either of our experts, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hi, Larry Callahan. One comment briefly about what was said there, because I used to do a lot of Title III cases. I think a lot of people don't know what a pen register is, and that records the phone numbers used, not the conversation. And so it's not necessarily directed. It just registers that, not the conversation. So that's why the law is different. You might think a pen register deals with conversation. It does not. That's not what I was going to ask about. With the onset of the use of drones, and maybe in the future with satellites, to both record For example, observing someone's backyard or plants or maybe even conversations. Where do you think the court will be going with respect to Fourth Amendment issues that's going to be going forward for the next 5, 10, or whatever into the future?
This is Kent Scheidegger. I think there is a potential for change there because you see the same sort of pattern that we saw in the thermal imaging case, that where technology improved to the point that you could discern more private information, the court called a halt to the use of the thermal imagers, even though the device in use in the particular case couldn't show very much besides this, you know, vague hot spot on the roof. The potential that improved thermal imagers would show more private information was enough to trigger Fourth Amendment protection. And you could see the same sort of thing with flying over people's houses. I mean, if you fly over somebody's house in an airplane and look down, you can't see very much. But as technology improves, you're going to be able to see a lot more. And so potentially we could see some movement in that direction.
And that'll also involve conversations, I would think, that you can pick up that way. One would think.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is Dean Mazzoni again. Just Dean, just as you said, so like Kent hit the nail on the head. As the technology increases, so that the government's able to do what some would say more intrusive searches, certainly more comprehensive searches, then I think the Fourth Amendment doctrine is slowly changing to keep up with the pace of the technological development. So that's definitely a trend.
We still have one more question pending. Let's go to our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. There seems to be a problem with extending the Fourth Amendment beyond what language of the Fourth Amendment actually provides to cover surveillance generally, even when it doesn't involve the private space of an individual. So the Fourth Amendment provides personal, you know, protections against invasion of personal property, personal space, real property belonging to someone. But he doesn't really contemplate broad gathering of information that is released out into the world. And people are trying to argue for reclaiming, holding on to privacy rights to information once it's out there and no longer protectable by themselves. So it seems to me that we really need to be talking about is a new amendment to the Constitution that would recognize a right to non-surveillance and not just the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable search. Otherwise, we're going to be stretching the words beyond any reasonable meaning.
Well, I think you're right about the scope of the Fourth Amendment. It says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. And the general right of, you know, against surveillance, of gathering up public bits of publicly available information to a greater extent than we ever could before, is a threat to privacy not covered by those words. I doubt that we need a new constitutional amendment, though. I think we could make the appropriate balancing by legislation. Dean?
Dean Mazzoni, do you have something on this point?
No, I have no comment, I guess.
Okay. Continuing on with our questions, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got another caller here.
Hi, it seems to me that you don't have to own the premises or the vehicle to have some security. It should be possible for any cell phone company to make a contract with its users that we will not release your pen register information or your conversations or any records we have about your services without a warrant. And therefore, you would have the reasonable expectation of privacy by contract.
I think this is Dean Mazzoni. I think that's a good point. I think, it's a good point in terms of how, you know, does courts judge what society views as a reasonable expectation of privacy. I think there's a lot of language now. I mean, it changes so much, but I'm sure there are tons of contracts out there with providers that say things like that, although I'm guessing that they're going to comply with legal process at the same time. But certainly the big providers know that people now have an interest in this, and that they're aware that their records are susceptible to legal process. And I think you raise a good point, that to the extent that more and more providers protect their customers' privacy from the government, then that is going to slowly change what society would view as a reasonable expectation. But how you actually measure that and judge that, I'm at a loss. So,
Kent Scheidegger, you have something on this point?
No, I think Dean's correct. Yeah, you can contractually say we won't hand over without a warrant, but I doubt any company is going to contract to refuse a warrant.
Right.
And so you're kind of back to square one. If they go ahead and get the warrant, then the third-party disclosed information is discoverable by the government.
Another call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open at this point. And while we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, let me ask a question, another question. I think we've talked, maybe both of you have suggested that the court may be more solicitous of defendants. Maybe that's a trend. Maybe it's not. My question goes to the death penalty. Does that carry over to death penalty to defendants? Or what might you want to say more about the death penalty, since we really haven't discussed that much on this call?
The capital cases split 2-2 this year, and none of them were really blockbusters. I think they're doing error correction in a couple cases from state courts, but there wasn't a push in either direction. They continue to chip away on the substantive question of who is exempt from the death penalty, but I haven't seen a real big movement, and I don't see a real big movement in the offing. I don't think the Supreme Court is ready to take a giant leap in either direction on that. They're enforcing the federal habeas limits, and they're cutting back on some of the marginal cases on eligibility for the death penalty. But that's about all that's happened in the last several years.
Dean Mazzoni, anything on this point?
Yeah, I would just say it's interesting because it shows you how important individual justices can be, you know, to the extent that, you know, Justice Scalia, he's an originalist and, you know, Fourth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, big originalist, but he's also an originalist, and he'll say, you know, capital punishment fits perfectly fine with his view of originalism. So I don't think you're going to see, as you do in the Fourth Amendment, people are like, oh, what, Scalia's, you know, pro-defendant? I don't think you certainly won't see that with just the death penalty generally, or as Kent knows, the idea of federal review of state convictions. Scalia is a big friend to the government in those circumstances. So I agree with Kent, everything he said, and I would just say that you can't, you know, just because someone like Scalia is, you know, finds these certain doctrines that he likes that kind of get you to on one side of the issue, it's not a general disposition now, certainly for him. So, depends on the issue.
A final question here might be a bit off the off topic, but might be a bit unfair. Have either of you taken a look at the cases of the coming term? And are there any blockbusters there? Anything of note there? Anything our listeners ought to be paying attention to? Cases that have been granted so far.
As far as cases granted so far, let me call that up pretty quickly here. I know we have one substantive Fourth Amendment case on a case from North Carolina where a police officer stopped somebody for having only one brake light working, which he thought was perfectly fine. And a state court made a decision in a case of first impression that one brake light is perfectly okay in North Carolina. So they've taken that one up. That's one that's interesting.
So it can't be used as a reason for stop, is that?
Yeah. It's right. That the officer stopped a person for something that is not an offense. Even
right.
though he thought it was an offense, and practically everybody in the state thought it was an offense, it wasn't. and therefore the evidence is excluded. So they took that one up. But they have shaped the question in such a way that it's a substantive Fourth Amendment question rather than an exclusionary rule question, which makes it less interesting than I think it would be if it had been an exclusionary rule, good faith exception question. There's another case on threats, kind of a follow-up to Virginia versus Black. That's Elonis versus United States. Do you have to subjectively intend to threaten, or is a statement that the recipient would think to be a threat sufficient? There's a technical question on appeals and habeas cases, Jennings versus Stevens out of Texas. So those are several of the upcoming cases.
Undoubtedly more to come. Well, it looks like we've exhausted the questions from our audience. We've got a couple more minutes left, so I want to give each of you a chance to express any final thoughts you might have. Let's go in the order we started with. Dean Mazzoni, any final thoughts?
Nothing more except that, as I said, you know, I'm repeating myself as to, you know, Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. I think you're going to see, you know, along the lines of the Riley and the worries, big, you know, it's a lot of moving of the doctrine when it comes to surveillances and searches and seizures in light of, you know, technological change. And the court shows itself, to, in my opinion, to be pretty aware of what's going on and is acting accordingly. So, again, it's not always necessarily going to be the conservatives going to be pro-law enforcement, but I think they're all principled, and we can kind of see where things are going, and that always helps. I think it helps everybody, include defense attorneys, prosecutors, and judges, in terms of, you know, trying to fashion our cases, making our rulings in light of where we see courts going, and that includes the Sixth Amendment stuff that you mentioned. So,
Ken Shattucker, a final thought.
One case we didn't mention that probably should be mentioned before we leave is the Paroline case.
Oh, yes, Paroline. Yep.
Restitution for child pornography victims, and whether a person who just helps create the market by buying child pornography is liable for some, all, or none of the damages of the victim. And the Supreme Court basically said some and then punted back to the trial court figuring out exactly how much. It was kind of a muddled result. As we grapple with these difficult problems of victim restitution. So I think that should not go unmentioned.
Very good. Well, I want to thank both of you on behalf of the Federal Society, Dean Mazzoni and Kent Shattucker. We certainly appreciate you having reviewed all these cases and presented on them, a lot of ground to cover, so we certainly appreciate that. To our audience, quick note that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is this Wednesday at 4 p.m. when we'll be discussing the use of criminal background checks in employment and other matters. The Obama administration has asserted in the past that such policies disproportionately exclude minorities from being hired. In the last year, the EEOC has even sued several companies that screen criminal background records, asserting that the practice violates Title VII. So we'll be discussing that on Wednesday at 4 p.m. It's conceivable that we'll have other Teleform conference calls scheduled this week, so do take a look at our website and monitor your emails for other calls as they might appear. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.